So it's once we have this way of, you know, thinking about the scriptures and testing them out, then it's very helpful to apply to our doubts when we hear things that, you know, bother us or that don't make sense to us. And again, it's not saying that you should force yourself to believe it by saying, well, yes, the Buddha is a reliable guide, so I better believe everything he said. But really, check the things out. And like I said before, check it at your own level of how you practice and see how the teachings have helped you and how the teachings have proven true in your own life. And through that, gain confidence in the Buddha for the things that are more obscure. But even then, don't force yourself to believe something, because that doesn't work anyway, you know? It just doesn't work. So if there's things that, you know, you still can't make sense of, then just say, okay, I'm putting those on the back burner for the time being, and I'll come back to them later. And as I learn more, I'll check them out, and, you know, like this. So that you don't just throw them in the garbage can saying this is rubbish, and you don't take it on in blind faith, but you just say, you know, I have to think more about this and I need to get more information. And then, you know, as you listen to teachings more and more, then things go in and different people explain things from different angles that will, you know, light up the light bulb at some point. You know, and as you accumulate merit, as you purify, then the mind becomes more receptive. And so just do it like that, yeah? And don't feel bad or feel like you're doing something wrong because you have doubts, okay? Now, there's different kinds of doubts. The deluded doubt, that one is not so good because that's really inclined towards the wrong view. But there's another kind of doubt where your mind is curious. And it's like, I don't understand this, but I want to understand it. I want to understand how it works. And with that kind of curiosity, then you're open to learning and you ask questions, you read, you investigate, you try and learn. And in that way, over time, you clarify your doubt, okay? But the kind of doubt you want to avoid is the one that is like, well, I really don't think so. And then that one very easily goes into, no, that is just hogwash. That's make-believe. That's blah, you know. And then you form a very hard opinion about it. And having very tough, cynical opinions about things does not help us on the path. Granted, ego mind gets a rush out of having, you know, a cynical, well, you just make me believe this kind of mind. You know, it's kind of cynicism mixed in with arrogance. And it doesn't really want an answer. It just wants to be stubborn and obstinate and say, bleh. Do you know that? Do you have that kind of mind in yourself somewhere? Yeah? So that mind is not very good because it creates a lot of negative karma. And it's totally shut down. It doesn't want to listen to anything. Okay? And so when we're like that, then clearly we can't learn. Yeah? So if you don't understand anything, just keep an open mind about it. Yeah? Put it on the back burner for the time being. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I started out, you know, the whole idea of merit sounded really weird to me. What's this merit business? Trying to accumulate merit. Yeah? Sounded like, you know, gold stars on my homework or something like that. I just didn't get it. And, you know, but then I remember one time my mind was just really stuck and kind of, yeah, just stuck. And I was, this was before I ordained, and I was talking with one nun about it, you know. And she said, oh, when your mind gets stuck, do practices to purify and accumulate merit. And she encouraged me to do the mandala offering. So I did the mandala offering, you know, simply because she encouraged me, even though it was part of this merit business I didn't understand. But when I did it, it really relaxed my mind, you know, just kind of relaxed the mind and made it more open. So I thought, oh, okay, maybe there is something to this merit thing, and keep investigating. Okay, and so, you know, kind of like that, yeah. Where instead of saying, oh, merit, it sounds like gold stars and your homework, what are they talking about? Yeah. Oh, I'll tell you another one that drove me crazy. Okay, so, you know, I grew up in a Jewish family, which, like most theistic religions, you know, God's up there, and your job is to please God. Right? Were you told that when you were little, that you should please God? So, that always bothered me, please God, because, you know, how to please God wasn't always so clear. You know, you were supposed to do it, but exactly what the rules were not so clear. And so when I started doing one practice in Buddhism, there was a line in it that talked about pleasing the guru. And I just went, oh, God. Pleasing God, pleasing the guru. What do you mean? I have to do a song and tap dance so that somebody's pleased with me? Can't I just be myself? Why do I have to put on some fake act to please somebody? Because you see, you know, very often as a child, I was encouraged, like many girls are, that we're supposed to please people, right? Weren't you encouraged like that? You know, we're supposed to please people. Boys can do what they want. They can swear, they can jump, they can do blah, blah, blah. They don't get criticized, but we're supposed to please people. You know, so when I heard please your, you know, please the guru, I just went, ugh. I just could not, you know, it just didn't do anything for me. And yet it was in a very, very important practice, this phrase. And it bothered me every day when I said it, you know, except when I was having an attentive cognizer and just read it anyway. Yeah, and I remember once going to see my teacher and telling him how much that phrase bothered me. And I can't remember what he said. It might have been then. Yeah, which was often the reply. But what was really interesting, you know, so I kind of had a not very good attitude towards that, and yet it was something I knew that was important. So this is going to sound totally crazy, what opened my mind to this, okay? So I was in Israel, and I went with some friends to the West Bank for Passover Seder. And the family that we were with, the daughter, who was 26, was very, very religious. And she was telling me about how she tried to please God. And I said, what do you mean by please God? And she said, well, you know, when you really love somebody, you try and do things that make them happy. And I thought, oh, well, I really love my teacher. Maybe that's what it means. Like, because it's true, when you really care about somebody, you want to do things. That's the key. You want to do things that make them happy. What I really resisted in this practice was being told, you have to say every day 6 times, I shall, do to please the guru. But when she said it like, oh, yeah, it's, when you're fond of somebody, and then naturally that comes, that you want to do things that please them. Oh, okay, maybe that's what it means. And so that really changed the whole thing for me. Yeah? Stupid story, isn't it? In the middle of the West Bank, a Jewish girl saying this to me, and then that changed. Okay, let me tell you another story. I mean, I have the Buddha up here in the weirdest forms for me. So another thing that bothered me, what was it? Oh, they say in the teachings, the guru is kinder than all the Buddhas. Wait a minute, I really love the Buddha, and the Buddha taught the Dharma, and I'm the Buddha's student, and how could my teacher be kinder than the Buddha? How is that possible? And so it bothered me for many years. And then, because the argument they give for why the guru is kinder is, yes, the Buddha, turned the Dharma wheel in this era, but it's your teacher who taught it to you. And so in that way, because that the teacher was the exact one who made that connection with the Dharma for you, in that way, they're kinder than all the Buddhas. How can somebody be kinder than the Buddha? So one day, you were in the car. We were in Bangalore. And what's his name? Sakit. Sakit was driving us somewhere. He was our Indian friend from the Dharma Center where I was speaking. And I don't know how we started talking about this, but he wound up asking me the question of, it was like, do you appreciate being learned, learning how to read? Do you appreciate the person who taught you how to read? And I said, yeah. And then he said, do you care at all about who developed the alphabet? And I said, no. it's nice they did, but the person that I'm really grateful to are the people who taught me to read, not somebody back in history who developed the alphabet. And then I went, oh, this is what it means. Yeah, that's what it means. I don't know if I say anything at that time? I don't think I did. No, but I was just inside. I was like, oh. Yeah, the person who invented the alphabet is like the Buddha. But who do I really appreciate? Is it the person who invented the alphabet or the person who taught me how to read? It's the person who taught me how to read. So that's like the guru who teaches me the Dharma now. Okay? Yeah. So these kind of things, happen when you least expect them. So my point in telling these two strange stories is that keep things on the back burner that you don't understand instead of forming hard, rigid opinions and rejecting things. Yeah, that's my point. Yeah, because things that you don't understand now, this Jewish girl or Sakit, this Indian man, may appear to you and doing, you get it, okay? So keep an open mind. I never told Sakit that story. Okay, inference by authoritative testimony is not the first choice for gaining knowledge. It cannot be used to prove evident phenomena that can be known by direct perceivers, or to prove slightly obscure phenomena that must initially be known through inference. So we have to be very clear with the situation for using inference by authoritative testimony is. Okay. During debates, participants must use inference as much as possible. The quality of a debate deteriorates if students mistakenly believe that quoting a well-respected master is sufficient to prove a point that actually needs to be realized through inference. It is unsuitable to abandon our investigative abilities and blindly quote scripture to prove a point. However, scriptural statements on these topics are useful because they inspire our practice, they reinforce our understanding, and they suggest new perspectives. So His Holiness very often tells the monks, the Tibetan monks, don't just quote scripture. And he wants them, you know, because he, especially when he talks about the mind and rebirth, and he says, you have to learn to talk to people who don't believe in Buddhist scriptures about these topics. And you can't just quote a scripture for them because they don't believe the scriptures. So you have to use inference and learn how to prove that rebirth exists, you know, in that way. Yeah. And so it is with all these things, to try and use, you know, either direct perceivers or inference as much as possible. And, you know, and then for the other things, use authoritative statement. Yeah. But like His Holiness said, scriptural statements are useful because they reaffirm, they often reaffirm what we've discovered by inference, or they inspire a new way of looking at things and give us a new argument to use. So we do use quotations. Of course, sometimes understanding what a citation means is not so easy. An example of gaining knowledge about the subtle workings of karma by using scriptural inference is the syllogism. Consider the statement, through generosity comes wealth, through ethical conduct comes upper rebirth. It is non-deceptive in its subject matter because it is a statement that is free from faults by the threefold analysis. Okay, so this statement is from Nagarjuna's Precious Garland. You could look at verse 438. A text written by a great master, its content cannot be invalidated by the threefold analysis. Okay, so it's asking us to look. Remember the threefold analysis? Okay, so the first one was there's no reason to reject it based on its description of evident phenomena. So we studied, you know, Precious Garland. Did you find anything to reject in that way? How about the second one? Did you find anything to reject based on inference? You know, when he was giving all the syllogisms and so forth for understanding emptiness? Yeah. Then the third reason, was there any contradiction in the explicit and implicit meaning? And did the scripture contradict each other, the first part and the latter part? No, he was very consistent throughout. Okay? So in that way, you can say, okay, you know, Nagarjuna was valid. The scripture's valid. He made this statement about karma. Yeah. So some people say that this statement about karma, generosity comes through wealth, and an upper rebirth through ethical conduct. I'm sorry, wealth comes through generosity and upper rebirth through ethical conduct. They say that that actually can be proven by inference, and it's only the details of particular beings' karma that only the Buddha can know. But then other people say that this statement itself needs to be proven by scriptural authority, that you can't just use regular inference. However, it does make sense if you just think about it, doesn't it? You know, that by giving, you receive wealth. It makes sense, you know? And by keeping ethical conduct, you have a good rebirth. Yeah. Now, a thief may disagree. A thief may say, wait a minute, by giving, I lose wealth, you know? By stealing, I gain wealth. You know, but clearly that thief is not really thinking properly.
I was just wondering what the, in Nagarjuna's text, what you would specify as the explicit and the implicit if you're trying to actually compare that, because I wouldn't know what would be the implicit.
Yeah, generally it's his main subject matter is considered to be emptiness and then, you know, the path. Although when you read the text, it isn't, I mean, there's certain areas where it's very clearly, explicitly emptiness and other areas where it's not. But because it's often considered one of his reasoning texts, then it's just put in that category. The sutras of both the Pali and Sanskrit traditions contain accounts of the Buddha and his disciples encountering living beings in very peculiar situations. The Buddha would often describe the karma that the person had created in a previous life that brought about that situation. Okay, so here we're seeing where we can learn about karma, okay? And also learning that the Buddha did in fact talk about karma and talk about it in terms of rebirth and creating the cause in one life and experience, seeing the result in another. The connected discourses with Lakana, which is in the connected discourses volume, is dedicated to such accounts. It is helpful to read and think about these and use them as guidelines for our behavior. So we're not going to get, you know, factual inferences from those stories, but, you know, they guide our mind through example. In a way, or through analogy, to understand major points about karma. Okay, the Sutra of the Wise and Foolish also describes the subtle workings of karma and gives us much food for thought, as does the Wheel of Sharp Weapons. That talks a lot of things about karma. And it makes sense, doesn't it? When it, you know, in that text, it's... if you want to read it, it's in the book Good Karma, which is available in our Dharma and Things room. So it's a thing. Yeah, it's a functioning thing. So, you know, because it talks about if such and such happens to you, this is a result of doing this and that. And it's very helpful, you know, because a lot of the things it describes are situations that we've experienced. So it gives us a clue to what we may have done in the past that created the cause for that experience. And then we know, okay, if that creates that cause and I don't like that cause, I better stop doing this action. Okay? So very helpful in that way. We ordinary people must use inference by authoritative testimony to understand the subtlest clear light mind. So the subtlest clear light mind, it's part of us. It never disappears. Okay? But we can't. It's not an evident phenomena, and we can't even know it by inference. Yeah, we have to rely on authoritative testimony. I mean, that's how out of touch we are with who we are and, you know, what's with our mind. According to Nyingma and to the Nyingma and Kargyu presentations, the clear light mind is not only the subtlest mind that manifests after the dissolution of grosser conceptual levels of mind, but also the clear light mind that is present and pervades all mental states, even when the grosser levels of mind are manifest. However, the Guhya Samaja Tantra says that the clear light mind manifests only after the grosser winds and minds have dissolved. So here's this discussion. Some texts say that the grosser levels of mind and wind energy must dissolve before the subtlest mind is manifest. And other traditions say, no, along with our gross minds, if you can get very quiet and extremely precise in your mindfulness, you can spot the clear light mind, the subtlest clear light mind. Highly realized practitioners with direct experience of this clear light do not need to prove its existence by inference, because for them it is an evident phenomenon. Okay, for those of us who have not had this experience, it is very obscure, and neither direct perceivers nor factual inferential cognizers can prove its existence. So this, what this is talking about is when we die, our gross consciousnesses absorb as the body, the energies and elements in the body lose the ability to support those consciousnesses. And then at a certain point, you have a white vision, and then a red vision, and a black vision. And then after that, the subtlest clear light mind manifests. So this is what's coming here is a very good example how His Holiness takes something very difficult to understand, throws it in the middle, doesn't explain the terminology for the new people, but knows the older people will understand it, and then goes on, and that's fine, because we aren't expected to understand everything at once. Okay. So the minds of white appearance, red increase, and black near attainment that appear during the dissolution process are probably very obscure phenomena for us as well. We may get some inkling of these increasingly subtle states of mind culminating in the clear light by considering that the 80 indicative conceptions are classified into three levels according to their subtlety. I'm not going to explain all this terminology because then we'll never get anywhere, okay? But it's just a good example of how His Holiness teaches. Thus, the combination of wind and mind that are their underlying foundation, these three levels of the white, red, and black, should also be increasingly subtle and culminate in the clear light. For example, we may see three clouds moving at different speeds in the sky, one fast, another slower, and a third barely moving at all. Although we cannot see the winds moving the clouds, we can infer that those winds are moving at three different speeds. Also, tantric texts that discuss the various levels of mind describe many things that we can verify through direct perceivers. So now he's talking about how we can see those scriptures as reliable. Okay, for example, we have experiences of the awake state, dream state, and state of deep sleep, which are increasingly subtle states of mind. This gives us confidence in the accuracy of other topics presented in these texts. Okay, so if we, you know, when those texts talk about the awake state, the dream state, and then deep sleep, and we can see, you know, three different levels getting progressively subtle, yeah, then we can say, oh, okay, he's talking about gross minds and subtle minds and extremely subtle minds. Yeah, kind of like, you know, awake state, dream state, and deep sleep. Yeah. Furthermore, we do not know of any evidence that contradicts the existence of the clear light mind. Do we? Except, well, I haven't seen it. I mean, that's our proof for what we don't want to believe. I haven't seen it. Good proof, isn't it? Yeah. I don't have a heart because I haven't seen it. Yeah. I don't have intestines because I haven't seen them either. Yeah, very reasonable. Okay. Furthermore, we do not know of any evidence that contradicts the existence of the clear light mind. Therefore, based on the authoritative testimony of the Buddha and those meditators who have direct experience of the subtlest clear light mind, there seems to be more grounds for accepting its existence than disproving it. Okay? So, more grounds to accept it than to disprove it, so we take it. You know, it's not an inference, but we accept it because it kind of makes sense. Okay? And then, you know, later, after you've created the cause, you know, to enter the tantra and you start doing certain meditations, then, you know, we can get some kind of feel for maybe what this actually means. For us ordinary beings, the level of realizations of those who are more highly realized than we are is very obscure. So we don't know the level of realization of anybody who's higher than us. We don't even know the level of realization of anybody who's lower than us, for us ordinary beings. Yeah, for Aryas, they'll know that kind of stuff, but we can't. In his commentary on the ornament entitled Golden Rosary, Tsongkhapa said that no matter how many reasons ordinary beings apply, or how much logic they use, they cannot infer the level of realizations of highly realized practitioners. However, for those with higher realizations, the level of realizations of people inferior to them are evident phenomena. So our level of realizations is open, you know, all the holy beings can see it, but we have no idea of anybody else's level of realizations. If we are speaking with our teacher in the classroom, and he says that there is a text on the table in another room, we can accept that as true by believing his words. While in general the book is an evident phenomena, to us at that moment it is very obscure. Yeah. We cannot see it with our eyes or know it by inference. At that time, the only way we have to know the book that's on the table in the other room is by relying on the testimony of somebody who does. However, simply citing our teacher or a scripture that says all phenomena are dependent, are empty because they are dependent, will not help us to understand emptiness initially. Okay? Yeah, because all phenomena are empty because they're dependent. We have no idea what dependent means. We probably don't really understand what the term all phenomena encompasses. And we certainly don't know have an inkling of what emptiness means either. So just repeating, you know, citing our teacher or a scripture that says that doesn't really give us any new information. It makes our mouth wiser. Okay, like I said before, we have a wise mouth. But what is the difference between trusting our teacher's word to know the book that's on the other table in the room and to understand emptiness? So we have two examples. You know, our teacher says, oh, there's a book in the other room on the table. And we trust that. And our teacher says, all phenomena are empty because they're dependent. Do we just trust that too? Does that help us at all? You know, we don't understand it. Okay. So what's the difference between those two things? In general, a book is an evident phenomenon. We know what it is and have an image of a table with a book and a table without one. Yeah, his words clarify for us which one it is. However, initially, we do not have an idea of what emptiness is, or if we do, it's the emptiness of our stomach, which is not the kind of emptiness we're trying to realize. Quoting our spiritual mentor, that phenomena are empty does not enhance our understanding of emptiness, even if we have tremendous devotion to our teacher. However, our trust in our teacher will inspire us to contemplate and meditate on emptiness according to the teachings, and through that, we will understand the criteria, the three criteria of the syllogism, and in time we'll gain an inferential, reliable cognizer of emptiness. Okay, so we have to think of the difference between those two situations. Because otherwise, you know, a Samkhya teacher will come along, or some New Age guy, you know, will come along and say, you know, we all emanated from the one cosmic substance. Wow, doesn't that sound good? That sounds really great. Yeah, we're emanations from the one ethereal, mystical, cosmic substance. Yeah, wow. Yeah, how much do I have to pay to be your teacher, to be your student? You know, and we just believe it. It sounds great. Okay, but do we really understand anything? Yeah? Do we really understand anything? We're all manifestations of the one mystical cosmic substance. Sounds fantastic. Does it really educate us at all? Yeah. Whereas if somebody comes up, even somebody you don't like, and says, you know, you have a problem with your anger. That is useful information. Yeah? That person's really helping us. But we usually don't like that person. But the one who tells us that we're emanations of the universal cosmic mystical substance, we think that guy's great. Okay, you see how foolish we are sometimes? Okay, so now we have a reflection. So this is your medicine meal, your medicine meal tea. And tomorrow you don't eat breakfast, so it's also your tea for tomorrow morning, okay? So first, who do you trust as an authority, and in what areas do you take them as authoritative? And this is important because in different areas, we have to trust different people as authorities. Okay, I have one Dharma friend, and, you know, she was so upset, you know, one time riding in the car with our teacher, and he didn't know the directions of how to get somewhere. And she said, but the scriptures say the guru is the Buddha, and the Buddha's omniscient, so he should know the directions for how to get from here to there. And he didn't know. She was really shaken by it. Okay. So, you know, is it necessary that you trust your teacher for knowing the directions? Who are you going to trust more, the GPS or Siri or your teacher, if your teacher's never been to a place? You know, maybe Siri knows better. I don't know. Excuse me, Lord Buddha. But, yeah. I mean, I'm just talking how we carry things to extremes. Okay. I had another friend who, you know, went to ask Circumrimche. You know, he had legal problems with his landlord, you know, in his house down in Dharamsala, and he went to Rinpoche to ask for advice. And Rinpoche said, get out of here and go ask a lawyer. Yeah? He said, I don't know anything about that, you know? Go ask the lawyer. You know, when you need trouble, when you need legal advice, your lawyer is going to be an authoritative, give you, you know, an authority on it. You know, not your spiritual teacher. Yeah. Although people ask their spiritual teacher everything. As I've told you before, I had one woman ask me, you know, if she should marry this one man. And I said, I don't know. You know, what do you want to do? And she said, well, I don't know. Lama X told me I should, but Lama Y told me I shouldn't. What do you think? I was going to be the deciding vote. You know, unless she was going to continue to ask other lamas about marrying this guy. You know, if I were that guy, I don't know if I would want to marry her. You know, if that's the criteria that she's using. Okay? So, you know, we have to, you know, use authoritative testimony in reasonable circumstances and recognize who is an authority for what. Yeah. I mean, lots of times people come here and they say, you know, oh, our electric wires are going blah, blah, hoo, hoo, da, da, underneath the, you know, whatchamacallit that the water is in, but then that interacts with the thing from the, what do you call it, the one up there where we keep the gas. Yeah, that one, the propane, you know? And then, you know, but then that line goes here and this one goes there and then, you know. And so what do you think we should do about the problem? You know? Or they ask me about the tractor, you know. The who's the Jesus, you know, some part that I've never heard of, you know, broke, you know, it broke. What do we do? Fix it. But don't ask me how, because I don't even know what the part is. Okay. Yeah, do you do that sometimes? Go and ask people for advice on things that they're going to have no idea of what to advise you on? Yeah. Okay, so to what extent is that person fully reliable in terms of knowledge of that topic? Yeah, we're transferring the database from, you know, from ETAP to Bloomerang. Bloomerang. Not boomerang. Bloomerang.
No, it's
bloom. It's bloomerang. It's not boomerang. Yeah, they bloom your data. They don't boom your data. Yeah, so maybe. No, B-L-O-O. Yeah.
Yeah. Correcting all the spelling.
So, you know, we're doing the data transfer, you know, so we're transferring the data of the Ushutoba to the Agugugu, and there's this program that does it, but the program, you know, told me that I have to install a widget of some kind so that the program coincides with my, you know, with my Microsoft Edge. Why is it an Edge? How about my Microsoft Plateau? I feel more stable on a plateau than an Edge. You know, and we're transferring the data, and, you know, you know, they're making all the M's into T's. What do I do? Yeah, please ask the Buddha. He's omniscient. Don't ask me. I have no idea. Okay. Those of us who are not scientists, second point, know the existence of atoms, the healthy range for human blood pressure, and so forth through accepting the word of scientists. Do we investigate their qualifications as authorities on the subject, or do we blindly accept their word? Third question. When politicians make various statements, to what extent do we check the reliability of their information and the reliability of their words before believing their statements? In what other areas of life do you rely on the testimony of others to know something? Do you check the credibility of the person first, or do you tend to believe something simply because somebody said it or you read it somewhere?
Unfortunately now, there was a time when in certain media, you could trust what was presented. Mm-hmm. And I think now we've developed to a point with the internet and social media and all of these things that our investigation has to be a lot more thorough than it used to be.
Yeah.
That's just the bottom line.
Yeah. I still think there are some publications that are pretty reliable. If direct reliable cognizers, inferential reliable cognizers, or other reliable scriptures contradict a particular scriptural passage, or if scientists can irrefutably prove that a scriptural statement is incorrect, we should not accept it. Vasubandhu's Treasury of Knowledge describes the structure of the universe as a flat world with Mount Meru at the center, four surrounding continents, heavenly realms above, and hellish states below. The sun and moon are said to be the same distance from the earth, and the sun is only slightly larger than the moon. I do not believe that we should accept this description as accurate. My reasons for this are based on the guidelines the Buddhist scriptures have set out for evaluating the veracity of a teaching. In Vasubandhu's time, the structure of our solar system was a very obscure phenomena. Now, due to scientific advancements, some parts of its structure are evident, while other parts can be known through factual inference. So it's a whole new situation now. This new information affects our understanding of Vasubandhu's description. We must apply the threefold analysis necessary for inference by scriptural authority to determine whether to accept his statements regarding our solar system. The first criteria, that the statement is not contradicted by direct perception of evident phenomena, is not fulfilled. One way of proving the non-existence of something is to prove the existence of its opposite. Vasubandhu describes the sun and moon as being almost the same size, 51 yojanas, which is 20,400 kilometers, and 50 yojanas, 20,000 kilometers in diameter, respectively. However, reliable scientific instruments have measured the sun's diameter as 1,392 kilometers and the moon's diameter as 3,480 kilometers. It is clear that the sizes of the sun and moon, as written in the Treasury of Knowledge, are inaccurate. Furthermore, this treatise says that the sun and moon are the same height above the ocean, 40,000 yojanas, or 16 million kilometers, and that they circle Mount Meru. Okay? Mount Meru, by the way, is, you could say either Mount Everest or maybe, what's the one in Seattle? Mount Rainier. Yeah. So Mount Meru is near the center of the universe because it's near us. Right? Yeah, that's totally makes sense. Okay. Reliable scientific measurements have calculated that the sun is 150 million kilometers and the moon is 384,400 kilometers from the Earth's oceans. Here, too, we see that the measurement in the Treasury of Knowledge are inaccurate. In addition, there is no scientific evidence showing that the there is scientific evidence showing that the sun does not orbit the earth. Okay. Another criteria for inference by scriptural authority is that the scripture lacks internal contradictions. As a learned practitioner from Nalanda Monastery, Vasubandhu would have based what he wrote on material and Buddhist scriptures. We find various measurements and structures of the solar system presented in Buddhist scriptures. The presentation of the shapes of the world in the flower ornament or Avatamsaka Sutra differs from that in Vasubandhu's treatise. So, you know, they have different ideas. And I think it's totally different in Kalachakra, too. Because there are inconsistencies among Buddhist scriptures, a literal reading of their presentation of the world's structure is not reliable. I consider myself a student of Vasubandhu, and I have full respect for his great learning and spiritual attainments. At the same time, the Buddha advised us not to accept teachings merely out of respect, but to investigate them. Having followed the Buddha's instructions and made a thorough investigation, I believe that if Vasubandhu were alive today, he would rewrite Chapter 3 of The Treasury of Knowledge in light of current scientific knowledge. This description of the world found in the Kalachakra Tantra and the scientific description also differ in several ways. It is possible that the description in the Kalachakra Tantra is designed to point out parallels between the external world and our internal human physiology, not as a description for space travel. I think that's right on. In that case, it is valuable to use in meditative practice, although I find it difficult to accept literally. Okay? So, because in the Kalachakra, they make many analogies between the external elements and the elements of our body and then different consciousnesses. So it's a whole way of meditating, you know, using these analogies. But it's not going to be a good map if you want to get from here or somewhere else or to the moon or, you know, send something around Pluto. Poor Pluto. He's gotten... Yeah, he got kicked out, you know. Yeah. Well, don't you feel sorry for him? Poor Pluto. Okay, so reflections on spiritual inference. Some people grow up in an environment where questioning a scripture's authority is unacceptable and disbelievers are shunned or threatened. Anybody grow up in that environment? Yeah, some people probably yes, some people probably no, where you dare not ask questions, and you, especially of what the scripture said, and, you know, if you don't believe them, you're shunned or threatened or kicked out or humiliated or who knows what. These experiences may cause us to mistrust religious authority. That's an issue with people in America, except for the people who accept things blindly. They don't have issue with religious authority. But many other people who don't accept things blindly do. And yet, they want a spiritual practice. Yeah. But they're stuck from, well, I don't believe that, and... You know, I'd mistrust spiritual authority, but I want to believe something, but who can I trust? And I can't trust anyone. And then, you know, they get really tangled up, and it's kind of sad. Yeah? You know people like that? Yeah. In Buddhism, no one asks us to have blind belief. Instead, we are encouraged and even required to scrutinize a scripture's reliability by means of the threefold analysis and by examining the qualities of its author. So yes, we really are encouraged to think about these things, but I have noticed that, you know, in the Tibetan debating system, there's certain questions that they will debate and have a really rigorous debate on, and those are fine. And then there's questions that we, people from another culture, tend to ask that they've never even thought of. Yeah? And, you know, and our questions sometimes really question the basic assumption of the system. And those questions don't go over so well with some teachers. Yeah? Yeah. But I think it's important that we keep asking them. Yeah, because we can't just make ourselves believe. So just even, I mean, when we're studying the collected topics, the whole layout of physical matter and, you know, kind of the four kinds of particles, the different kinds of form, the different kinds of sound, color, you know, all these different things, you know, it's very different from you know, scientific knowledge now. Yeah, I mean, we don't believe that everything's made of four basic particles. Yeah, we give them a whole periodic table. Yeah, so I think it's fine. You know, if we're trying to study that topic and learn the system of debate and how they relate to things, then we kind of go along with it, even though we know it isn't true, because it will help us understand certain other points that will come up later when we're studying the scriptures. But that doesn't mean we need to literally accept that as true and throw out our scientific knowledge. In fact, we can still say, you know, I believe in the elemental chart, is that what you call it? Periodic chart. You know, I believe in the periodic chart, and that's how I, you know, I live my life towards that. But, you know, I'm wanting to understand when they refute certain things that they do it in terms of this system where they talk about partless particles and smallest particles and such. So, you know, I take that so that I can learn the refutations and then apply the refutations to other things that I might believe. Okay, is this making sense to you? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we don't need to just throw out and say, oh, those people, you know, they're so stupid. They don't know anything about physical matter. I mean, they made guesses that were quite appropriate for their time in history. And that's fine. Yeah, that's completely fine. I don't think, I say this, okay, because sometimes people in a modern culture, we tend to look down on people from cultures that are not so modern. You know, oh, you know, your culture didn't have the wheel until when? Yeah. Oh, really inferior. And we just, you know, we have a certain cultural pride. And that can be very detrimental if we really want to learn the Dharma. Because, you know, then it's kind of like we're demanding, okay, for me to believe something, it has to correspond in every way to my culture. Because my culture is 100% correct. Why? Because it's mine. But if you look at it, our cultural beliefs and scientific knowledge are not 100%. Yeah? So why are we demanding that some other kind of knowledge correspond with what we know, you know? If we open our mind, we might be able to learn a lot from that kind of knowledge. And, you know, without insisting that our Western way of doing things and thinking is the one right way. Just a little cultural comment. What do you think? Some truth to that? Yeah. Because you can see, you know, even in our foreign policy, how do we relate to other countries? Our culture, through our culture. And people have to negotiate the way we negotiate, and they have to think the way we think. And we aren't willing to open our mind and say, well, gee, many other people have different ways of thinking. Yeah. And it would be really helpful for us if we learned their different ways of thinking, because then when we talk to them, what they said would make a lot more sense to us. Okay. It is easier for serious learned practitioners to examine a scripture's reliability. Oh, I just read the first sentence of the other one. Okay. These experiences may cause us to mistrust religious authority. How many of you until recently mistrusted religious authority? Yeah? How much? Many of us still mistrust certain religious authorities? Okay. In Buddhism, no one is asking us to have blind belief. Instead, we are encouraged and even required to scrutinize a scripture's reliability by means of the threefold analysis and by examining the qualities of its author. It is easier for serious learned practitioners to examine a scripture's reliability. Such practitioners have studied Buddhist scriptures for a period of time and have gained an understanding of the four truths and emptiness based on dependent arising, which facilitates their ability to examine scriptural authority. Yeah, so when you know something about the system and, you know, and you have that knowledge, then you can examine the authority, you know, different scriptures much better. How do people who are new to Buddhism approach the issue of the reliability of Buddhist scriptures and of the Buddha as a teacher? When you hear a teaching that tallies with what you have experienced, a teaching that touches you deeply and that in your heart you know is true, you will naturally think the Buddha accurately described my experience in one area in a way that no one else has. He may have some special knowledge or spiritual realizations. Yeah? Have you heard something in the Dharma that's touched you in a way that nothing else has? Yeah? So that makes us think, oh, maybe there's something else here. In addition, when you put a teaching into practice and experience beneficial results, you will easily think, I followed the Buddha's instruction on how to deal with this disturbing emotion, and it worked. Other teachings he has given may be equally valuable. Like the Kalamas, you trust in the Buddha and his teachings. Your trust in the Buddha and his teachings will increase due to your own experiences, as will your receptivity and interest. Did you know the story of the Kalamas? Yes. Yeah, there were a people that had many spiritual leaders coming through, telling them to believe different kinds of things, and they didn't know what to believe. When the Buddha came through, they asked him what to believe, and he said, you have to determine for yourself. And then he taught them the four immeasurables, love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And they meditated on those, and they thought about them, and they realized, gee, this is a good teaching. And that gave them trust in the Buddha's words. So there's a famous phrase in Pali, it's e-pasiko, which means come and see. That's what the Buddha kind of told them, come and see. Listen, try it out. In this case, it makes sense to continue learning and practicing the Dharma, using your intelligence to examine the teachings. If you don't find a particular point illogical or contradictory, you can accept it. This is not blind belief. The Buddha does not pressure anyone to follow his teachings and gives us full liberty to examine them. But if you don't fully understand a topic and doubts about it remain, leave it for the time being and focus on the parts that help you. You can come back to these more challenging topics later. Dharmakirti instructed that inference by authoritative testimony should be applied only to topics that are important to know in order to make spiritual progress. In general, cosmology, political issues, history, gender traits and roles, and so forth are not included. As Buddhist practitioners, we must scrutinize scriptural passages about such topics, weigh them against contemporary ideas of human rights, scientific knowledge, and historical analysis, and come to our own conclusions. So there, that is really revolutionary, you know, because in Buddhist scriptures, in talking about political things, you know, Nagarjuna has wonderful advice for leaders, you know. But in other scriptures, for example, there's statements made about women that are totally opposite to contemporary viewpoints, at least in the West. So His Holiness here, by saying that, you know, is saying that we have full freedom to examine the scriptures, and that, you know, the issues, cosmology, politics, history, gender traits and roles, and so forth, are not included in what is considered important material in the scriptures for us to accept or understand. Okay? And so similarly, you know, there's things in Tibetan culture that don't correspond with our culture. We are totally free to not follow those things. And in fact, His Holiness often makes fun of Westerners who try and be, you know, look like Tibetans and be Tibetans. He always says, but you have a big nose and it gives you away. Yeah? So I think this is very important because, you know, the Buddha lived in ancient Indian society, you know, where there was the caste system, which he did reject. But it's very interesting. Later writers from either Indian culture or even Tibetan culture included certain aspects of it, you know, in their writings because it was, you know, contemporary in their viewpoint. Okay, so now the culture is completely different on, you know, the whole thing of sexual ethics, very different. Yeah, according to Vasubandhu, and I tell this story because it nearly sent me through the roof, you know, according to Vasubandhu, one example of sexual misconduct is if you pay for a prostitute. No, somebody else pays for the prostitute, but you sleep with her. That's sexual misconduct. You know, to me, that's overlooking the whole issue of prostitution. And to me, the whole issue, you know, the whole topic is something that we need to really address, you know. Do women really choose to be prostitutes? Or are they conditioned as such or sold into it? Or, you know, we have to look at this and not just say, well, if you pay for her and somebody else sleeps with her, you know, that guy committed non-virtue. How about if you sleep with her? Isn't that non-virtue too? You know, she's 14 years old and scared out of her mind. Okay. So don't get me going on that topic. But so I think you're getting the point that, you know, there's a lot of cultural things. And so we are free to investigate those things. We don't have to accept the cultural elements, either that are in the scriptures or that our teachers may accept. Yeah. I often tell the story, you know, one of my precious teachers thought George W. was an excellent, wonderful president. And others of my teachers think Tibetan tea is great. You know? So if I got all wigged out because, you know, I don't believe in Buddhism because, you know, the teacher who teaches me emptiness also believes George W. was a great president. So therefore, I'm not going to listen to his teachings on emptiness. If I think like that, who's missing out? Okay, it's me. So, yeah. maybe none of you have these problems that I have. You know? Maybe everything goes down very smoothly with you. But sometimes you act in ways like it doesn't.
Something I think W. Bush looked with at his holiness with some kind of loving eyes.
Yeah.
So his holiness could see that he had a good heart, basically.
That he had what?
Had a good heart, that he could identify his holiness's qualities.
Yeah.
Some of them.
Yeah.
So, and if that may have influenced his politic, that would have been good. Mm-hmm. But he may not have the right circumstances too, and the right education and whatever, many yeah. factors.
Yeah, it wasn't his holiness who said George W. was an excellent president. But
oh, yeah,
you're
but,
right.
Yeah,
he could,
but,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
W. could see his holiness's good qualities, and we have to credit him for that. But his seeing his holiness's good qualities doesn't make his decision to invade Iraq a good decision. Yeah.
For me, it helps me to understand, it helps me to understand that the teacher may have seen something in this politician role made.
Yeah. I think the politician saw something in the teacher.
And I think also vice versa. Yeah.
So, okay. Yeah. And so, for example, you know, in Tibetan culture, human rights means Tibetan rights. Okay, human rights does not extend beyond Tibet. It does not extend to women. It does not extend to other cultures. Yeah, it's very interesting. It's not that they actively deny human rights to that, but when they hear the expression human rights, their mind goes instantly to Tibet's political situation vis-a-vis China. You know, and when you bring up women's rights as human rights, you know, it doesn't click.
So if we take those scriptures we accept and work, and others we deny, isn't the risk that maybe we rationalize the Buddha's teaching? This is not suitable for me, so I let it be.
Okay.
And the next point is, if we make such explains, so people who are criticizing Buddhism say, oh, you take only what you want, and the Buddha said the wrong things as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, those which we deny now.
Yeah. Okay. So I think it depends, you know. We need to question everything. But here His Holiness is saying, you know, it's questioning the Dharma teachings, that's what it's important to question, not the political views or cultural views or those kind of things that are written in the scripture. So I don't think His Holiness would say, you have to differentiate. Why did we come to learn the Dharma? Did we come to learn about emptiness, or did we come to learn about astronomy? If we don't believe in the presentation of, of Vasubandhu, are we, being contemptuous of the Buddha's teaching? Or like His Holiness, are we being faithful to the Buddha's teaching because we're able to examine the issue and say, you know, it doesn't make sense? So similarly, things about human rights now, yeah, in ancient India, they didn't have the idea of human rights. Okay, now we have that idea. Yeah, we can look back to the scriptures and we can see many things that validate our idea of human rights now. But we can also see things that don't. Yeah, so does that mean that we aren't good Buddhists if we adhere to our conception of human rights instead of the rights there? Does it mean that we're bad Buddhists if we think that women are just roaring to sleep with the men, and that, it's completely, the view in the scriptures is that women just, all they want to do is jump, almost all they want to do, because they have to cook for the men too. But, is get into bed. And look at our culture. You know, who is it who's being called out for sexual assault? It's not the women, it's the men. Okay? But their view of women in Tibetan society and also in the scripture, completely different. So do we have to believe that version when in our culture it's exactly the opposite? You know, are we denigrating the Buddha's teachings when we don't believe that kind of presentation? I don't think so, because that's not why we went. You know, if I went to the Buddha's teachings to learn about women, you know, then, okay, yeah, I accept it. But that's not why I went. I went to learn the path to liberation, you know, and the status of women in society. You know, okay, they believe what they believe. I'm going to believe what I believe. Yeah. And also, you know, I think that my belief kind of is more in tandem with what the Buddha's actual thought was. Because I think the Buddha taught the Dharma for all sentient beings, not for half of the population. Okay? So I'm exaggerating a little bit here, the view of women in the scriptures. It's not that bad. Okay? But it's definitely different than how it is today. You know? And if we import that view, or even the Tibetan view of women, into the West, people will stop coming to Dharma centers. Does that help the spread of the Dharma? Does that help human happiness? No. Yeah? So, you know, on those issues, I think it's fine we disagree. On issues like, did the Buddha teach rebirth? Then that's an important topic that is completely embedded in the Buddha's cultural, you know, the Buddhist worldview. So there are people who come along and say, well, I don't really know about rebirth, so the Buddha didn't teach it. Yeah, that I think is dangerous. Okay? Because if you take rebirth out of Buddhism, then there's a lot of things in Buddhism that just will not make sense. Yeah, if there's no rebirth, then what's the solution to suffering? Drink, that's too expensive. You know, have an atomic war. That's the easiest way to stop human suffering if there's no rebirth. But I don't think anybody really wants an atomic war, a nuclear war. Okay? So also then some people say, well, but there's all these kind of mythology kind of things in Buddhism. You know, what about that? You know, can't we take that out? And Rita Gross, she passed away a few years ago, but she was a historian, a sociologist. She was a university professor. But anyway, she was very good about the myths and things like that, or the myth-like things. And she said, those are used to increase faith and to expand our mind to think in symbols and analogies. We don't need to take those literally. Yeah, so it's not necessary to throw them out as old cultural baggage that we need to get rid of. Use them in a certain context, you know, to help you understand things or to give you faith. But you don't have to take them literally. And some people take some of those things literally, you know, like the Buddha came out of his mother's womb and walked seven steps and said, this is my last rebirth. You know, so some people take that literally and some people don't. And for me, I don't really care. You know, because I didn't come to the Dharma to learn about miracles. I came to learn about the path to liberation. If I wanted miracles, boy, I could have stayed Jewish, you know. I mean, what can beat the Red Sea parting? You know, that's a pretty good miracle. Why should I abandon the Old Testament miracle or New Testament miracles? Didn't Jesus do something with fish? You know? So, I mean, he walked on. Sorry, I didn't study Christian Testament, so I don't know this stuff. I just hear, yeah, something loaves and fish, and what did he do? Yeah. Anyway, you know, so if we came to a religion for miracles, then fine, any religion will do. They all have good miracles, okay? But I don't know about you, that's not why I came, you know? And it wasn't to learn astronomy, and it wasn't to learn gender studies, and it wasn't to learn, you know, cooking, and, you know, I came for the path to liberation. So those are the things that I'm focused on. And the rest of it, sure, we can have different ideas. I don't really care. After recommending that the Kalamas examine the various teachings they heard, the Buddha asked them a series of questions about what they observed to be the results of attachment, anger, and confusion. They replied that the results were consistently unpleasant. When questioned about the results of the absence of attachment, anger, and confusion, the Kalamas replied that they were pleasant. So maybe it was he taught them this and not the four immeasurables. Maybe I got it wrong. They're coming. Yeah, okay. After having them examine evident phenomena by means of their own experience, the Buddha taught them the meditation on the four immeasurables, and they practiced cultivating love, compassion, joy, and equanimity for all sentient beings. Again, the Kalamas experienced for themselves the beneficial results of following the Buddha's instructions. Having ascertained the reliability of some of the Buddha's teachings through their own experience, they came to trust the Buddha and his teachings and took refuge in the Three Jewels. Their confidence in the Buddha, in turn, made them more open to hear more complex teachings on topics that could be ascertained by factual inference and inference through authoritative testimony. Okay, so it's a very interesting thing that as you learn and develop understanding of the teaching, that increases your faith and trust. As your faith and trust in the teachings increases, that opens your mind and makes it easier for you to understand the teachings. So faith, and faith isn't a good word. It's more like conviction or confidence or trust and wisdom. They feed one another, okay, in a Buddhist perspective.